Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, welcome to the Ethics Experts. How are you doing, Samantha?
I'm great. Thanks, Nick. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on again. We're going to give this one more try. We had a little bit of IT gremlins, fighting against us making it happen today. So glad we're going to try it again. So let's just dive right in, Samantha. You're somebody who I got in contact with through Roy. You're somebody who's kind of a thought leader in the compliance game, and I'd love to hear kind of how you got into the seat that you're in now.
Sure. I think like many people who are in compliance and ethics, we get here by chance, and I was no exception to that. It was totally random that I ended up in compliance. I definitely did not want to be a compliance officer, for example, if you'd asked me in grade school what I wanted to be. But I actually got a job when I was trying to finish my undergrad degree as a temp to a compliance officer and general counsel. I was the administrative assistant, and that was really my first exposure to compliance. And it gave me the opportunity to see what it was all about and actually figure out that I loved it. I was always the kid in school who could interpret complex concepts and make them understandable. So, the teacher would be up at the front of the class and they'd say, okay, so A, B, and C. And I'd be like, oh, so what you really mean is X, Y, and Z, right? And you could hear the class kind of like all collectively get it and be like, right. Oh, okay. And so I think that was a skill that served me really well because we're often tasked with, read this regulation and tell us what it means. And so that communication skill is something I've put to good use in this position. And so I really didn't know what I was getting into, but figured out that I loved it and I've never left. I've bounced around to a few different roles in compliance since finding myself here. And I have been in my last current position as a chief ethics and compliance officer with Cardinal Innovations Healthcare now for about a year. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been great.
So how many years in dog years was this first year as a compliance officer?
Oh my God, forever. It feels like it's one of those like crazy paradoxes where it feels like forever and no time at all in right. the same breath. I can't believe a year has gone by, but there was a lot of work that went into it to get to this point. So,
anytime we get into like a new role or it's a stretch role, or you're doing something that like we haven't done before, there's that, so-called imposter syndrome that sort of seeps in. And sometimes that can seep in kind of before you take the job. Like, did you feel any
of
that?
Oh my gosh.
And what did you, like, how did you get over that fear to kind of take the plunge?
So for those of you listening right now, you can't see me, but I'm blushing because I feel like Nick telling my story right now. If you talk to any of my friends or loved ones, they will tell you that I 1000% suffered from imposter syndrome. There was a part of me that didn't think I would make it in the first year. So actually, literally getting to the first year was a celebration. There were all the voices that said, you are not qualified for this.
Right.
You are not capable of doing this. And you will never know until you do it. It turns out that I actually know some of this stuff and I can do this, but it took a little time for me to get there. But gosh, I wouldn't change it for anything. It has been so rewarding and so, it's such a development opportunity for me. I'm always trying to grow and continue to learn and all that. And kind of this trial by fire is nothing but a great accelerator of your own growth and development. And it's just been wonderful. I have been a frequent attendee of all the SCCE events. Disclosure, I am on the board, so I should probably be transparent about that. But I love all of their conferences, and I've been tucking away little ideas every time I go. Even if the company that I was at the time didn't need that, if I thought it made sense and it was a great idea, I tucked it away, and I've been able to put some of that into practice here at Cardinal. And I've got to work with a great team every day. It's really, truly a lot of wonderful people at this organization. And it's a very mission-driven organization, so I can feel really good about what I'm doing. I've shared this previously before, and it sounds so cliche, but it's so true. I can get up in the morning and go to work and not feel like I'm going to work for the man, but that I'm going to work for mankind.
Ooh, I like that.
I know. It's so cheesy, but it's so
it's good.
True.
I'm the cheese guy. I like that.
I really, I like to believe that I'm a values-driven individual and to work for an organization that's really clear in doing good, you know, doing the right thing for our community and our stakeholders, just lines up really well. And it's easy for me to do. It's not uncomfortable. It doesn't feel like I'm necessarily working every day.
And how is that enhanced by the nature of your role? Like, we're talking about a purpose-driven, you know, whatever you called it, mission-driven organization.
Yeah.
How is that ship that you're on, or how is that feeling sort of enhanced by this kind of work that you're doing?
It's kind of like an exponent factor, right? Yeah. It feels like it's just multiplied somewhat endlessly, or at least there's potential for endless growth. You know, when you work at an organization that is mission-driven and committed to its values, it's just so much easier. The compliance role can feel like you're pushing a rock up the hill every day with no end in sight. Oftentimes you're a team of one or a very small team, and you feel like there's this inherent adversarial relationship with the business. But when you are all rowing in the same direction, you're all committed to the same goals and the same outcomes, and the same way in which you get there, meaning you do it the right way, it just makes things so much easier. There's so much less resistance. And so it's been, you know, a welcome development or advancement in my career. Not that, you know, the places I've worked at before weren't also committed, but to see how it all fits together so nicely has been really rewarding.
And, you know, you're somebody who I think kind of gets a lot of what we're talking about in the ethics experts. I think what that conversation is largely around is utilizing these, you know, kind of historically thought of as cost center functions to be a strategic lever in the organization. And I think you really get that well. And just as you talk about your role, I think there are some hints as to like how you were able to do that. I think you'd agree that like it's on us as compliance leaders to create that harmony that you were talking about, right? Like mm-hmm. the different departments. What did you do to help build some of that potential harmony as you came in your first year? You know what I'm asking?
Yeah. Absolutely. And it totally lines up with my own like philosophy about how to do compliance, right? Like not just about on paper, but how to actually do it. And so much of my philosophy is based on relationships. And relationships are based on credibility and trust, right? And so I had to do a lot of asking and a lot of listening at first, you know, especially in my first 90-day plan. My goal was really just to, you know, introduce myself, find out what the organization was doing, who are the people, who are the players, and then like shut up and listen. Because I needed to understand the organization and they needed to understand me before either of us could hope to make changes. I've listened to so many of the amazing people who've come before me say, you know, be careful in your, you know, new role not to come in like a freight train and just make a bunch of changes. Right. You'll piss off a lot of people and you really won't succeed long term. And so I really just wanted to talk to people and then shut up and listen and figure out what I could do to be helpful. Compliance to me is always a service entity. We're here to provide a service and to support the business. So, you know, how can I help is my favorite question. Like, what can I do? How can I help? How can we make this better or easier? And so, you know, listening to that answer will be very helpful and will tell you everything you need to know in most cases. You know, it's not a perfect world, but I think that was really integral to getting to know the business and the players and what was needed before making big changes.
And then how did you sort of prevent yourself from being gun shy around changes, right? Because that's some, you know, it's like we have imposter syndrome stepping into the seat. Trying to not make waves, you're trying to be effective, you're trying to listen and be sort of empathetic with folks, you're taking in the counsel from those around you saying don't change too much. Obviously you're going to change some things. So how did you sort of gauge and how did you prevent yourself from becoming gun shy on when to pull the trigger with respect to a Samantha compliance change?
So that's a fascinating question. It's a great question because you do have to find the balance. Because if you just wait and listen for too long, then folks will think you're ineffective or indecisive. I grew up north, so I am very rarely accused of being indecisive. In fact, I am often accused of being too direct. You know, I live in the South now, and I often hear, you know, you're not from around here, are you? Because I've got a little bit of that Northeast directness. And so I had to find the right timing to make those changes, but some of it was honestly a little organic. I joined just a few weeks before we started our new fiscal year. Yeah. And so some of the sort of goal setting and what are you going to do for the year was going on across the organization anyway. So there was that expectation that, okay, take your 90 days, but eventually we're going to want to hear from you what you're going to do.
Right.
I looked for some easy wins, like we often hear about, you know, talked in the leadership circles for a new leader. There were a few things that I had done before at another organization that I was like, great, I know how to do that. Let's do it. And then there were a couple of other things that I really didn't know or needed to learn more about. I have a number of programs under my compliance umbrella. I have compliance, ethics, privacy, program integrity, risk management, and internal audit. Now, compliance and ethics, I'm very familiar with. Privacy, I'm a little rusty on because I was in healthcare a number of years ago, but spent some time in the utilities industry. And now in internal audit and risk management are less familiar to me. And so I really had to brush up on those skills. And I'm a firm believer that I don't have to have all the answers. I just have to have smart people on my team. You know, I have to surround myself with people who know. And so, you know, that was part of it as well, was really evaluating the team and seeing, you know, who are you guys? What do you guys know? What do you want to do? What do you think we need to do next? Because mm-hmm. They know the business better than I do. They've got all the history, which is so valuable. Millennials are often accused of job hopping, right? Mm-hmm. And I am on the tail end of the millennials. And it took me some time and maturity to realize that it really is worth sticking around for a few years because the social capital you gain by building those relationships pays off in dividends every time.
Yeah.
You can be so much more effective at your job if you know the business and you know the company and you know the people. Mm-hmm. Which is worth so much more than a few dollars extra in your paycheck many times. And so, you know, getting to know the people and what they felt was next helped to develop that plan. And then quite frankly, the first year was like, okay, let's figure it out. We set some goals. We're going to meet some of them. Some of them we're not, but that's the point of stretch goals.
Right.
We'll carry those over into next year. And, you know, now we get to start the cycle again. And I'm just, you know, I think you've called yourself a nerd previously, and I can so identify with that because it's just so exciting to me. And the folks on our team are excited, and they're like, okay, yeah, let's go do it. We're eager, and we're really excited to be making a difference.
What were you shocked by in your first year? Both on the positive and the negative side, you know?
So I came from a company previously that was much larger. There were about 45,000 workers across several states with a small international presence. And Cardinal Innovations is smaller. We have about 900 employees, and we're pretty much all located in North Carolina. And so one of the things that I was shocked at, what was a little bit surprising, was how quickly things can happen at a smaller organization.
Right.
So for example, they wanted to do an introductory video. The CEO does a weekly message, and they were like, why don't we do a quick intro with you and the CEO's message this week? And so my boss and I, you know, he emailed me on Tuesday. We wrote the script Wednesday. We recorded Thursday, and it was published on Friday.
Wow.
And I was like, mind blown, because something similar at a larger organization,
you have to plan that a quarter out or something.
At least a quarter out. And I had several times tried to make something similar happen at other companies, and they just died on the vine because right. You couldn't get enough people to give approval. And so for this to happen so quickly, it was awesome, quite frankly. It's one of the things that I love about Cardinal, because you can really feel like you can see the fruits of your labor. You can see where the work that you're putting in right. is having an impact, right? The downside of that, or what is, will always be surprising and shocking, no matter how far along in your career you are, is that when things can move that quickly, everybody moves that quickly.
Right.
And that just means that everybody can do whatever they want without telling anybody else about it. And you're like, wait, you did what? Without telling who? And when did that happen? You know, and so because things can move so quickly, everybody just gets excited and they just go and do. It's a little bit like a startup mentality where there just isn't the structure in place yet. And so you've got to find, again, the right balance between we've got to move, we've got to get these things done. But who do we have to tell about it? Who are the stakeholders that we need buy-in? Did anybody run that by compliance?
Right.
You know, totally good intentions, but it can backfire if you're not careful.
So you said something, you know, you're over these five or six different sort of areas underneath the compliance umbrella. Some of them you're stronger in, some of them you're a little bit weaker in.
Mm-hmm.
You said something though that I thought was very strong and very powerful, which was, I don't need to know all this stuff. I just need to surround myself with people who are super smart. So we've all obviously heard that kind of approach before, but I think what prevents leaders from living out what we're talking about is this kind of insecurity or this fear that, man, I'm giving the keys of the kingdom, so to speak. I'm giving my job security away to someone else. How did you, like, if that didn't enter into your head, how did you frame it out? And if it did enter your head, how did you sort of extinguish that fear to go ahead and get that sort of true synergistic benefit to increase your impact and leverage, you know?
I guess I don't see, how surrounding yourself with smart people can hurt you if you're like, depending on what your goals are, right? So like, I want to train somebody on my team to replace me. That to me, like, there's nothing better or nothing, like no better indicator of your skills as a leader other than to prepare somebody else on your team to take your place. I guess that comes from the general belief that I will always be employable and that, you know, maybe if it's time for me to move on, there's something better out there for me. But I don't see it working against me. I need to have folks around me who have the answers that I don't. Because I have so many programs, it's not possible for me to have all of the answers. And so if I can, you know, tap somebody else or say, hey, you know, help me out here, I don't know this answer, or go look into this, or hey, how about, you know, you present this one because you know more about it than I do. I just don't see that as being harmful to me. I just see it as a quality of a strong leader. I've had the privilege, literal privilege, to work for some really great managers in my career. I've worked for some terrible ones. I think we all have. But I have worked for a few that have just kind of set me free and mm-hmm. said, you know, we trust you. We believe in you and your skill set. Go figure this out. You know, my boss would always say to me, you know, I think I know how I want to do this, but your idea is probably better than mine. So go figure it out. And that, just that phrase of, you know, was such a vote of confidence that it provided me that space to go learn and go figure it out, but also the safety and security knowing that I could come back and check in and say, hey, is this what you were thinking? Without going too far down the rabbit hole and being too far off the mark.
Yeah.
And so I try to create that same space for my team. You know, like, let's go figure it out. There's no stupid question. There's no wrong answer. Let's just go figure it out. You can't take yourself too seriously. Like, yes, this is important stuff. We do important work every day. But chances are most mistakes are not going to ruin the business. You know, the wheels aren't going to come off the bus. And we'll figure it out. Let's figure it out together.
So you're somebody that I kind of look up to you a little bit, because I think you know, it's inspiring how you took this role. I think what's even more inspiring is how you kind of created this opportunity for yourself. So I think just the fact that you kind of spoke to this sort of imposter syndrome as coming into this position is an indicator that, like, this was a stretch for you, or it was a new thing. It was a new horse you hadn't ridden. Look at that. I tied it back to your passion.
I see what you did there.
So it's a horse that, like, you hadn't ridden, right? But you had the confidence to take that plunge. And I think, you know, based on just kind of talking to you a little bit, you also did a lot of things to get yourself ready for that. And you're somebody who I think, so what I see a lot in the compliance game is people who don't take advantage of the stuff that's in our sort of, you know, network at large to grow their network, to get better and things like that. If you could share with someone who thinks, man, I'd love to do that job, I can't do that right now though, what kind of tips would you give them to, like, kind of get involved or to sharpen that sword or to hone that blade or whatever you want to call it to get themselves ready for that last plunge into the seat?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been preparing for this role for the last 10 years, right? I think we all sort of understand that if you want to have some kind of trajectory that, you know, growth trajectory, that everything you do will lead you somewhere. I never thought I would necessarily be here now, but I took every opportunity that was given to me or presented itself along the way to get here. So for example, Roy Snell, as you mentioned earlier, is one of my favorite people on the planet, let alone in this industry. And he has done more for my career and for the career of thousands of other compliance folks along the way than I could ever really put into words. But if I had to sum it up, Roy said a few things to me that will always stay with me, especially when I think I'm an imposter or when I doubt myself. I went to my first SCCE conference in 2013, and as always, Roy was hanging out in the hotel lobby in his jeans and sneakers and his, you know, sport blazer and sports coat, and he was so approachable. And I was literally that emoji, like with the stars in her eyes. You know, yeah. My first real big conference, and I was just smiling all the time, and Roy was so approachable. And you know, after the conference ended, he said, you know, you should write for us, or you should present at one of the conferences, or, you know, get involved. And I was like, what could I possibly say that hasn't already been said?
Right.
Or what could I possibly say that you would want to read? And he said, we need you. We need people like you, and we need your perspective. And I'm sure he has said that to everyone, that I was in no way special. But that reinforcement that I had a perspective that was interesting has stuck with me even when, you know, even today, like with your invitation to come on here, I was like, well, what can I say that, you know, hasn't already been said? But he was so encouraging and so supportive, so that anytime something was offered to me or a situation that I could partner up with someone or be helpful came along, I said yes. So my advice would be, say yes, right? Like, no matter what it is, no matter whether you think you're cut out for it, just say yes. Do you want to write for us? Yes, I'd love to. That turned, you know, I wrote a column for the HCCA for 2 years. Do you want to present? I did want to present. I wanted to be involved. And so the first year I found some folks to partner up with because I was too afraid, quite frankly, to give a presentation on my own. So we did a panel, you know, and then the next year I tried to present. I did present by myself. And then I sent an email to the conference organizers and I said, hey, I know you have a committee that reviews the presentation submissions. If you ever need some help with that, I'd be happy, you know, to help. And you know, lo and behold, I got to sit on the committee conference review committee for a few years. Just say yes and get involved. You know, the same philosophy of getting involved and helping at my organization is the same one that's helped me in the industry. And it for me, it wasn't solely about networking. Like, I didn't get this job because I knew the right person. It was just that I had been involved and done my homework. And like I said, tucked all of those ideas away and written articles that made my profile stand out. So Christy Granhart, I know you've done a podcast with her.
Yeah.
She's done a presentation in the past where she's given an example of two resumes where, you know, if you have the same exact qualifications as someone, you have a master's degree, you have the same number of years in the profession, you know, the same certification, but you've also written 10 articles and presented at 12 conferences and, you know, people can go out and they've heard you on podcasts and all that stuff. It just elevates your profile and makes you stand out. And that's really what I think, you know, helped me with this role. Was I had enough other stuff to make me credible, to demonstrate that I could do this job, even if it didn't necessarily look like on paper that I could.
And there's the tangible and the intangible, right? It's great to have that extra page on your resume that lists out your publications and your speaking engagements and so forth. Those are great sort of tangible things for a recruiter to look at and grab onto. But then there's also this whole intangible piece where you had a bunch of conversations with people in the industry as you built those, and you did research and you
absolutely
and your network enhanced and your skill set enhanced because your exposure was broadened and all of that kind of stuff.
Yep. And your perspective changes, right? So for me, my experience with networking, as I mentioned, networking never got me a job because I knew the right person. It was actually much more valuable to me once I actually had the job because I could then pick up the phone and call Roy or you know, 100 other people and say, oh my God, Roy, I don't know what to do. The boulder is bigger today and I can't get it up the hill and I don't know what I'm doing. Help me.
Right.
And that's why I try to encourage my team to go out and get involved. You know, yes, it may cost you some money to send someone to a conference, but I find again, the investment just pays out because you've got those connections and those resources. The compliance industry, one of the other things I love is, you know, we're not really bound by the same restrictions that sales teams and things are, where you can't share information.
Right.
I have never said to somebody, hey, I need help. Do you have an example of this? Or how did you do this where you are? And have them say, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you. No offense to my lawyer friends out there. Usually the lawyers are the only ones who say no, right? But the compliance folks really want to help. And that's been my experience every single time.
So let's shift gears a little bit. You know, there's a lot of social challenges happening right now across our country and within our organizations. And I personally think that, you know, again, speaking to compliance as sort of this underutilized asset in virtually every organization I come in contact with, like very few compliance teams that I deal with have been just truly unleashed from the C-suite to just go make the impact that you believe you guys can make. Money is no object, just go nuts, right? I don't hear that a lot, but I feel like given the social challenges that we're all kind of experiencing currently, there's a unique spot for compliance to help kind of weather the storm. What are your thoughts about this kind of challenge that we're all kind of facing right now?
This is for sure an unprecedented time, right? I was at a Target over the weekend and I saw a gentleman wearing a t-shirt that said 2020 sucks. And I thought that was like so frank and so simple. And again, comes back to your perspective, right? I don't think 2020 sucks, but it's definitely been a challenging time. Yeah. And there's being so much thrown at us as citizens, as members of communities, and for sure as employees, right? There's even less division, I think, between work and life now, particularly because we're at home. So I think, again, there is definitely a place for for compliance in this conversation. At our organization, we, again, have tried to be helpful. We were launching a new hotline around the same time that a lot of these social challenges were occurring. And so we wanted to make sure that we promoted that hotline as a way to have conversations, right? As a way to at least start the conversation. You know, the ownership of culture at an organization will always be a handoff or a balance between human resources and compliance. Like who owns culture is a very difficult question to answer, but we certainly play a part in it. And so, you know, I see one of my biggest roles as creating that culture and creating that safety where folks could speak up and have conversations. I think at any organization, you're going to have folks on both sides of the fence, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, right? There is division in this country right now. And so creating safety for a conversation, even if it's not pretty, or it's not perfect, or you don't know exactly what to say, just creating the safety to speak up, I think, is one of our main goals or responsibilities right now. Mm-hmm. And for me, one of the things I had to remember was that applies even to my own team, right? Even to the compliance group. You might assume that, well, they're the compliance folks, right? Like they run the hotline, they know they can speak up, right? But I wanted to make sure that they did, that they knew that those challenging and difficult conversations could occur even amongst our own team, and that there was safety even for them. So, you know, we started some things internally on our team. We use Microsoft Teams. And so we created a channel for us to share resources and have those conversations. I saw a great resource that CNN partnered with Sesame Street to talk to kids about racism. You know, I don't have children, but I know many of our team does. And so I shared that as something that they could look at and review and really just continue to get educated. So I think that's one of the key things that we can do is that safety right now.
Yeah. And then I think a lot of what we're talking about is like a foundation of trust, right? Like you're obviously a purposeful organization. I think kind of the main foundational elements of a culture are going to be how sort of purposeful and mission driven is the organization and how closely does that resonate with my individual why, right? And then the other piece is sort of trust. Like, do I trust the people? Do they trust me? Do I feel an ownership of this thing or am I kind of an outsider? So how do you accelerate the building of that trust, not only on your own team, which you're probably easier to affect because of its size or because of its sort right. of geographical proximity, but then how also do you carry that forward to the larger organization? Because I think that's where a lot of the real magic can happen. And that's really what we're trying to affect when we're talking about culture. How do we build that speak up culture on this distributive workforce that are in multiple locations in this complex regulated organization?
So if someone could invent a magic wand for me, that would be great. Because, you know, it's such a difficult thing. I mean, we as an industry talk about this all the time, right? One of the things that I, you know, one of those tricks that I've tucked away that I heard at a conference came from Microsoft. They rebranded their hotline marketing to center around trust. And so instead of saying you are required to report an issue if you are, become aware of it, they said, we trust you to speak up. And again, just like one word, switch the conversation. Like, I'm so nerdy, I just got goosebumps.
Me too.
So, you know, I took that, and at Duke, we created our whole code around trust, building trust with our customers, building trust with our regulators, building trust with each other. And we tried to carry that throughout the code and everything we did. And we've carried that, I've carried that with me, now to Cardinal Innovations, and we're trying to use the same terminology. Trust takes time. Trust can't be fixed overnight or improved overnight or instilled overnight. And it takes action to back it up. I think if you look at a lot of the research out there about why employees don't speak up, the number one concern is often retaliation. But number two, followed closely behind, is often they don't think anything will be done. You know, why bother? Why speak up? Why take that risk if you're not even going to do anything about it?
Right.
So, you know,
why do I care about it if you probably don't?
Right. Walking the walk, right? Walking the walk and showing that all the concerns are addressed. And I, you know, there's obviously boundaries and limitations. You can't go blabbing about action, you know, personnel actions and stuff like that. But you've got to start somewhere. And build the trust over time. You know, we've incorporated trust into some of our messaging around our hotline where, you know, if we trust you to speak up, so you can trust us to respond appropriately and protect you against retaliation, that kind of thing. It's a two-way trust, right? And so, you know, walking the walk and sticking to your process and having the conversations. We're rebranding our hotline it was called a whistleblower line. Obviously there's some connotations that come along right. with that. And so we're rebranding it to be the Let's Talk line. So no matter the issue, yeah. let's talk about it. Let's be adults. Like, let's talk about it. Right. And so, you know, we know conversations take courage and, you know, sort of breaking it down and being really simple and conversational about it. Is the approach that we're taking. So I'll let you know if it works, right? Check back next year. Yep. I'll have a year's worth of data for you. But we're hoping that we can create that space for employees to come forward and let's just talk about it. If we don't know it exists, we can't fix it. So let's talk about it.
And what was the kind of health of your sort of compliance team when you came in? Like, how much kind of rebuilding did you need to do? And how much kind of trust did you need to build? How much English did you have to put on the ball? And how much of it was more just kind of reinforcement of a great thing that you kind of stepped into?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of reinforcement. I don't necessarily think there was rebuilding. It was more just about, okay, you know, what does the playing field look like now? And where do we want to go? And how do we get there?
Yeah.
You know, kind of just continuing to move the ball down the field. The individuals who were there before me did a great job standing up the program, and they built a lot of the foundations correctly. It's just about continuing to add maturity. You know, I know in your last episode with Mary Shirley, she talked a lot about artificial intelligence and data and all of that stuff. And I get overwhelmed because we're not quite there yet. We still have some other things to do first to put in place. And sure. It's very easy for me to think, oh my gosh, I'm not doing enough. Or like, oh my gosh, I'm not doing enough fast enough. But things have to happen in an order, right? It's kind of silly, but you know how people often say it's 11:11, make a wish, you know, and you often find yourself looking at the clock and you catch it at 11:11. I often look at the clock and it's 12:34. And I just, that to me is a reminder that like 1, 2, 3, 4, everything has to happen in an order. And I just have to remind myself that we're doing the best we can. We're on the journey just like everybody else. And you know, every policy change that we make or every new thing that we do is just continual advancement of the program. And we'll catch up to Mary and that artificial intelligence stuff one day. You know, we're doing what we can, and we're making a difference where we can.
Yeah. But I think there's a parallel there, right? Your job or our job as compliance, professionals, at least with respect to our, the team of people that we're kind of entrusted with, is to kind of meet them where they're at. And mm-hmm. I think as leaders, we also need to meet our organization where it's at. And we're all kind of on our own journey, and not to get too trite with it, but, you know, it's just kind of one foot in front of the other. And, you know, you never plant an acorn and then tomorrow you have an oak tree. It takes time for that to grow and those roots to be laid down, and you just kind of build day by day, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the phrase that comes to mind is, Rome wasn't built in a day, right? Again, so cliche, but, I'm definitely playing the long game, you know, now that year one has come and gone, I'm looking at years 2, 3, 4, and 5, right? Not just year two, but like where do we want to be in year 5, and what do we need to accomplish along the way to get there? I think if you talk to anybody on my team, they'll tell you that I'm a planner, that, you know, yes, we need to get things done, but we need to have a plan in place in order to get there. So unless you start at step one, you'll never get to step 5.
So let's fast forward. It's 10 years from now. It's 2030. Where is compliance? Where are we at? What are we doing? What has changed over the last decade?
Well, I think one of the things that I hope to see more of, that we'll have to see if it comes to pass, but there's a conversation going on now in our industry about compliance officers serving on boards. And that, to me, is a really fascinating evolution, you know, something that's coming. It's not quite here yet. LRN did a program a few months ago where they brought, you know, several different stakeholders together. There was someone who told us about board recruiting and what that looks like and board composition, and then 5 or so compliance officers that were on public and private boards. And then, you know, someone who could tell us about, okay, well, if you want to be on a board, here's what you need to do as an individual to be a good candidate. Okay. And it was just a really, really interesting conversation, because I think a lot of folks are starting to talk about it as a best practice, right? Like, if you want to be a good, responsible board, you should have a compliance officer on your board to help you navigate your environment. But it's actually not really happening out there yet. And so I hope that we are given a seat at the new table, right? And can serve in that sort of advisory capacity on the board level, and that we're able to use that expertise to affect change in even greater reach. From my understanding, there are some limitations around whether or not we have specific enough interest. We, in fact, have a lot of general interest, and they're often, because of the limited number of board seats, there's often not enough specificity. So it's all about marketing yourself and your knowledge. Mm-hmm. But I really hope we're given that opportunity. And then, you know, similarly, you know, within an organization, I just hope we are continually involved to greater and greater extents, right? You know, the elevating the position to a C-suite role. I know there are a lot of folks out there who say, don't take the job if you can't be, if you can't report to the CEO. And I just don't think it's always that black and white. But I do hope that, you know, the position continues to grow in respect and notoriety, and we're under, you know, valued more. And we move away from that concept that you brought up earlier of being a cost center, and more of a value add or a value driver. I know those are, again, very cliche business words, but I do really truly believe in what we do. And I know that while some of it can be difficult to quantify, you know, the avoided litigation costs, the avoided fines, the avoided time you have to spend responding to inquiries, and all of the stuff that happens when things go off course or go astray, all of that costs money and time and resources and people. You know, from a compliance perspective, you can add so much value to the business that way. And then, you know, from the ethics perspective and the culture perspective, when you have happy, engaged employees who feel valued and want to come to work every day, you're just going to get so much more out of them than if you have employees who are like, man, my boss is a jerk. Like, I'm going to work from 8 to 5 and that's it. I'm not going to give another minute. You know, who is this guy? What do they want? You know, tell them to kick rocks. You're not going to get the same value out of that employee. And so much of that is driven by culture. So I think we can continue to beat that drum, and to help our organizations, get the outcomes that they're looking for.
Well, I love that picture of the future. It's a lot of what I would probably project forward as well. I think that seat at the table is a big one. And I think the light bulb going on at the top around employee engagement, around the fact that, hey, we are sort of, you know, we are firmly planted in a new economy that is knowledge work, where people are the assets, and really to get the best out of our organizations and magnify our impact, it's going to be about empowering those individuals who are kind of volunteering to come to work every day. You know, this is not,
right.
This is not communist China.
Yeah.
You're done, you know?
I think the business roundtable recently was the group that moved away from, you know, driving value from shareholders to driving value to stakeholders. So, right. You know, that's one shift or one indicator of where we're going. And I think this cancel culture is another thing that, you know, really sort of reinforces our value. You know, how many CEO had to step down in recent weeks because of things that have come to light, or, you know, the CrossFit, like such a huge business. And now this gentleman has stepped down, and things can happen so quickly. Right. And part of our job as compliance officers is really reputation management, you know, and managing that risk, to know that when you go to sleep at night, you don't have to worry about what's going to be on the headlines the next day. And if we can continue to sort of help guide everybody in the right direction and make sure that the values aren't just words on paper and that we live and breathe them every day, we're a great insurance policy, and we are really worth every dollar that we're paid.
So. Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, the way I kind of view the ethics and compliance department is it's kind of the anti-fragility department. It's meant to make the company less fragile, right? Both in terms
and more of resilient
risk, yeah. And more resilient and all that kind of stuff. And like, what asset an organization is more, you know, fragile than the reputation of the organization? And how susceptible is that, especially in our cancel culture, to be for something innocent to be misconstrued and then forget about it, somebody stepping down and the reputation's wrecked and you got to rebrand it, all that path of like disaster. We can really help a lot keep our company from going down, you know.
For sure. 1,000%. Again, I'll steal and butcher another quote, but you know, the Warren Buffett quote around it takes 25 years to build a business and 30 seconds to destroy it, or something right. along those lines. And gosh, I can't tell you how true.
I like your version better, I gotta say. That was
and how evident it is, right? Like, we are literally seeing that time and time again in the last few weeks. And that is really the role that we play, is to reduce or minimize that impact as much as we can.
How can people find you, Samantha? How can they learn more about you and pick your brain some more?
So please reach out to me. I will nerd out on this stuff all day long. And, you know, it's really important to me to give back to the industry in the way that so many others have helped me along the way. So if you want to chat about this, you have questions, you want to nerd out, mentoring, I'm all about that stuff. So find me on LinkedIn, Samantha Kellen, you can find me there. Or if you want to send me an email, I actually have a personally branded email again.
Wow. You know,
talk about tips and tricks, right? One of my favorite people out there, Ty Francis, has, you know, ty@tyfrancis.com. And I was like, wow, that's genius. $30 a year or whatever, you can have your own too. So email me at sam@samanthakellen.com and I'll definitely get back to you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
Learned a lot. We will see you on LinkedIn and we'll see you at the next conference. Hopefully you'll be presenting again.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be in person. I miss
all my people.
So, all right. Take care, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.